Now, you spent a lot of time looking for assembling your film on a lot of... what was your source mainly when you were looking for clips? What did you rely upon mostly of his film? What did you...
Just stuff that was going to tie in with the narrative, at, you know, at that moment. Like I knew when, say, doing Mutiny on the Bounty, that film was, you know, had massive personal significance to him because it you know, Tahiti was where he dreamed of when he was at the military academy. It was a bizarre repeat of his issues with authority in a military setting. There was the analysis of his rage.
Right.
You know, and anger in there, you know, and now he, and the anger of Fletcher Christian versus his anger to the director versus his anger at, you know, his upbringing and his father. So, because those were the themes, then I was just trying to pull images from the films that would just seamlessly weave into that personal narrative rather than just drop a shot of Meet on the Bounty for its own sake.
It had to
just be part of that flow. But it was normally dictated by the purpose of the scene.
Well, speaking of rage and feelings about his father, his mother with her alcohol problem, did you refer to that clip in Last Tango in Paris when he talks about his father being a whorefucker, bar fighter? You do?
Yeah, that's in there. That's actually by that stage in the film, in the documentary, it's got a bit more resonance because we've already learned that early on in the film. You know, so now it's just, you know, you realise that Bertolucci's lured him in because everything he's saying, you know, is true.
Yeah.
But that's in there. Come Last Tango.
And I'm trying to remember, did he, I don't think this is in your film, but he did express great disappointment or great discomfort with what he let out in Last Tango.
I think so. I think he was very, you know, I think he was very seduced by Bertolucci's creative ambitions and, you know, this attempt to let's revolutionise cinema, which Last Tango did in a regard, and that was to, you know, make it as real as possible and really, you know, just do away with fiction and make this, you know, bring back social realism.
But the vulnerability that he exposed in that film made him...
I think so. I think he was nervous even in the filming process. He would ask for company on set. He was listening to Bertolucci, but would get scared about where the direction, you know, where Bertolucci was taking him, and you know, asked his PA to be there. You know, because he just felt like he was going out of his comfort zone. And he was a very brave actor and just taking chances, but you know, he didn't want to necessarily bare his heart like that. But and then when it was all condensed in a feature edit, I think you know, it was a bit alarming to him.
One thing I never really understood is there's a wonderful little Maisel's documentary called Meet Marlon Brando. His promotion of the
film.
There's
clips in the film, actually. It's in there. Yeah,
right.
There's bits in there. Yeah.
And he was promoting
Moratori. He's a bit drunk in that interview, I think. You know, definitely. He's a bit drunk. He's had a few drinks in that, I can tell.
And you know that, you know anything about him, he loved women of some darkness, some color, some brownness.
Yeah.
And there's this woman, this very pretty Eurasian woman, who comes up and starts speaking French to her immediately. And I was always wondering, when and how did he happen to learn French? Because was it all just from
Paris.
Being in...
No, that was in the 40s and early 50s, I think. He would go to Paris. He went to Paris in Breaks After Streetcar, I'm sure.
Really?
Yeah, just off for escape.
Right.
He wanted to get out of town, went to Paris for want of anywhere else, and learned French there. He'd go and visit there and in his early days.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Just on his own dime, just go over because he had
I'm trying to think what friends he had there. Obviously, he developed a, you know, good friendship with Christian Marcond, who was a, you know, French director, and who I'm trying to think who else he knew in Paris. But he recounted one tale I remember where he was staying in a hostel with friends and woke up to find out that one guy was rifling through his wallet to steal his money while he was asleep. And he said he had the face of a jackal, and so there were obviously friends around him, but that was in Paris. So he had a group. You know, he went to Provincetown when in, you know, early Breaks as well, and he'd tear off. That was when he was quite itinerant and loved to travel and get away and be free. And
Perhaps you could sharpen my memory. There's a moment where he's talking about unwinding from doing Streetcar, and he would get on the motorcycle.
Oh yeah.
Go up to Harlem.
Go to Harlem, exactly. That was it, and he loved going there.
Yeah.
And that really appealed to him, and he listened to all those musicians, and they changed his whole.
Right.
You know, he loved drumming. I think he really developed. He loved rhythm as a youngster.
Right.
And he listened to the interesting footage, I think, from. I forget what documentary, but you know, there was a donkey pump in his garden that would do this, you know, in the farm, and it would make these strange noises, and the sounds of the train, you know, he'd listen to the train rhythm, and he loved that for the bongos and the African beats. But he'd go to Harlem. He used to hang out there.
I remember also you told me at Sundance that probably the most ambitious aspect of the physical production is that you replicated the inside of his home, which has now been destroyed. But then you did that by, presumably, many photos of the inside, and then directing the construction of it?
Yeah, exactly, sitting down with the production designer, art director, figuring it out, but had
did
lots
you have
of
like blueprints of how big
blueprints
it was
of the house, had blueprints of the house, it was knocked down, but had blueprints, had a video walkthrough of inventory of the entire property, so you could see it, had the Christie's catalogue with all the exact items of what he had as furniture. So it's not an exact representation, but it's kind of, I think the spirit and the tone is all there.
Mm.
You know, we obviously had to source from props houses in London, but you know, we knew our parameters,
right.
You know, the kind of stuff you would have liked, and we had a good instinct for.
Now, it wasn't a huge home, right? It was kind of a Japanese-style one-story home?
Yeah, exactly. It was a bungalow, but spread out over, but I think it was, I was surprised, actually, when I found out how many rooms there were in the end. I got this wrong. I think it was well over 10 rooms, or maybe 15. I always thought it was more confined. Because I only ever heard certain rooms being spoken about. But it was extended upon. But anyway, he spent most of his time in the bedroom, the den, and the living room.
Right.
Those were his spaces, really.
Mm-hmm. And the night in which Dag Tolle was shot, Brando was in the home, in his bedroom or something?
I think he might have been in his bedroom, yeah. And I think the shooting took place in the den.
And it happened in the living room, right?
I think it was either the living room or the den. It was one of those two, yeah. But Brando came in and did try to resuscitate Dag, and then he called the police.
Did he... I don't remember that he said... The film, for those who haven't seen it, you understand that it's essentially narrated entirely by Mr. Brando.
Yeah,
his own
exactly.
recollections.
Yeah.
Nobody else steps in, no talking heads. It's
purely... Exactly.
Which is the novel, you know, thing that stands out.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and actually, and, you know, and it was, I mean, this is not in any way so congratulatory, it's just to say that how terrifying it was, just knowing that it hadn't really been done before, you know, in terms of, like, a deceased person. Especially someone who was private as Marlon, you know, and not knowing how the extent of the archive that would develop, but to get to tell a sort of a layered story in the voice of somebody who was no longer around, you know, was exciting but nerve wracking just because I didn't have any precedence.
I just lost my train of thought. The something about Tahiti. It was the Do you know what is, has all that property that he owned on, how did you pronounce it?
Tetiaroa.
Tetiaroa.
Was
that sold? Is that still owned?
It's still owned by the family, yeah. And they just built an eco luxury hotel on there. Which was
It's
just been finished, yeah. Okay. So that's up and running now.
Like a 5-star thing?
I think like 6-star. I think
is there really,
I think there is, yeah, for like super. I think they've done a real bang up job on it.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the invite, but I'm not sure that coming.
Has there been any viewing by anybody in his family? Anybody seen it? Have they had a chance to catch it in?
All the family have seen it. There was a family screening. I wasn't present for one of the main family ones, but I saw Rebecca was there for one of the early screenings. She walked out actually after an hour, and I remember thinking, "Oh no, you know, there's something's wrong," and it was. But you know, it's more that she was just feeling, you know, just a bit overwhelmed at the fact that, you know, the presence of a dad that was on the screen was a bit much.
Was it because of the sad turn it takes towards the end?
I think she felt it was just, you know, a bit too much to digest, and it was kind of brought him back to life, and you know, probably more than she expected. In as much as, you know, he just carries, you know, his voice is ever present, and but then she came back and watched it second, third, fourth time, and has been helping us with press, and really has been supportive.
Was there any portions of his autobiography, which was titled Songs My Mother Taught Songs?
Yeah.
And what you were able to get on audio tape. I mean, there must have been a lot of things that you wanted to use, but you had to stick to your strategy, of course.
You know, there was nothing that I felt pained in leaving out, that it wasn't sort of relevant to the story that I thought of Marlon as I thought it ought to be and as I wanted it. But you know, I got access to those tapes as well, because Robert Lindsay, the biographer there, he recorded the stuff, so I got in touch with Robert, and he provided those tapes too, so we had that as a resource. So it wasn't all just the archive from the estate, there was other things that were appearing. I got in touch with Larry Grobel, the writer, who spent 2 weeks in Marlon on Tahiti. He found his tapes as well for us.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is great. He recorded that.
So I'm listening partly to something that Larry Grobel taped?
Yeah, some stuff of Larry's in there as well. Those are things in there too. And lots of other resources. I mean, because, you know, we didn't stop at the, oh, let's just do it from the archive. You know, exhaustively went, you know, to every place where Marlon had visited or been on a press tour, and asked to get radio, TV, photos from Australia, Japan, you know, Hong Kong, God knows what, Portugal, anywhere we could find that he'd been to.
Yeah.
We just, you know, collect that. And in the end, I think we had the most comprehensive compendium of photos, audio, and film ever assembled for Marlon Brando, basically.
Mm. One of the big heartbreaks of my viewing life is that there's a, if you've ever seen the Blu-ray of Cleopatra, they have on it a wonderful, almost, I think it's a 2-hour documentary about the calamitous making of that film.
Right.
And that was, you know, everything went wrong in that film.
Yeah.
And, you know, much more expensive. And right around the same time, of course, was the
mutiny,
thing, which is similarly kind of controversial.
Yeah.
He took the hit for being the bad guy. And he does what he can to say, well, listen, come on, you know, I mean, he explains his end very simply.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to see an assembled history of how that movie, which is actually not a bad film, but
it's a great film. I know, it's amazing because what all the fuss was about in the end. I mean, Brando was had high hopes for it.
Yeah.
I think it's one of my favorite. I love that Meeting on the Dance here. I love watching that.
I love the Ultra Panavision 70.
It's extraordinary, yeah. And I know people sort of criticize Brando's performance, but I think it was like really intelligent to start off with the fop, and you know, and have this kind of dandy character, because of the transformation by the end, where he's got the world on his shoulders, and I thought it was very clever that was done. I love that film. I mean, all sorts went on there. You know, obviously Carol Reed was fired. Which Brando was upset by, because he was, you know,
and he and Carol Reed was fired because management at MGM felt he was, or Aaron Rosenberg, they felt he was too,
I can't remember, I think they did seen some dailies and scenes, and they felt it wasn't going in a direction, so Lewis Marsden was brought on, who Brando didn't really get on with, didn't have a close dialogue with, I think he could be quite obstreperous around Brando once you'd lost him. You know, if he didn't have respect for you, then he could be a troublemaker. He was petulant. But I think he felt let down. I think he felt that, you know, he was privileged to see the story notes. He had ideas for Act 3. He had a real kind of view that if you started in Pitcairn's Island, as a, you know, if you had the chance now to rebuild a society from scratch, how would you go about it? And Brando wanted to play with this experiment in Act 3, but that really wasn't where the production producers wanted to now go, and so he felt that was a reneging on his early agreement, and he wasn't party to rewrites. So, you know, so he had cause to be upset, but, you know, he definitely you know, then he could be difficult. It wasn't all, he had issues with authority. He talks about it. You know, he was a bit irrational. It wasn't full of rage. Mm-hmm. He didn't like people telling him what to do. It was a reaction to his military upbringing, his dad, and, you know, so all that was going on as well. Mm-hmm. So, so you know, he was partly responsible, but he was also, you know, not irresponsible mm-hmm. either.
The only thing is, that I would fault about that film is that when the mutiny happens, he's in very trim shape. By the time they get to Tahiti, and Maimiti comes aboard and gives him that tongue lashing, mm-hmm. he's gained about 30 pounds.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that throws off that.
Yeah. He was, that was it. They had signs up when he was doing One-Eyed Jack that with them, you know, "Do not feed the director." They actually put that on the dining car.
Yeah, that's funny. I would love to see. I wish I could have been here at 11 so I could see the. I wanted to see it on the screening.
Oh yeah.
Because I've been watching it on my laptops.
Ever since then,
I really love that the big screen experience.
Yeah, oh, it's a shame. You know, I know they. I could hear a few that I didn't know. Yeah. It's a bit of a surprise. Yeah. I just heard the screen. I didn't know they were screening it myself.
Right. So, when's the Blu-ray going to come out?
I just know that it's out in cinemas in New York on the 29th, LA on the 31st, and then it rolls out.
Where's it going to physically play in New York? Where's the theater?
Film Forum.
Theater.
Landmark here, mm-hmm. and then it's. Then it rolls out to quite a few state capitals, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there's about 20 or 30, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's getting a nice run, and then it's out on Showtime on the 14th of November. Mm-hmm. I don't know when DVD will come out in between, I guess, and Deep Blu-ray.
Were you able, I mean, and one thing that I kind of miss here, I would love to have heard his mother's voice. She's not heard, is it?
No, and
I take it she never taped or
she,
recorded.
There was nothing of his mum. There was nothing actually. Unfortunately, you're right. But no, there wasn't nothing.
And I don't know. Just there's some people that you feel or you just would like to hear them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And because you get the chance to hear his dad, of course, but no, not his mum. Not his mum. Not that I
And his dad was part of Pennebaker production until, what was that, 63, 64 or something like
that? Yeah, whenever they kind of those projects dried up or Marlon sort of, you know, fulfilled his contract with Universal, didn't he, and he didn't want to. I think that sort of, you know, but you know, his dad was running the financial affairs right to the bitter end, and which is ironic in that given that Marlon was so, you know, hateful of his dad. And
there's a thing that I saw on YouTube where he and his father are kind of bantering a little bit in front of the... I think Edward R. Murrow did a thing.
Yeah, that's in the doc as well. Yeah, and that sort of illustrates Marlon's discussion of inferiority then.
Yeah.
And shows that his dad said that he wasn't proud of him as an actor.
Yeah, he was kind of being smarmy a little
bit. Yeah. Just saying that, you know, this is right after Marlon's got an Oscar, mm-hmm. and he's still not proud of him.
Right.
You know, he wouldn't even give him that credit.
Just to go back to Mutiny in the Valley one quick second, there was a kind of a damning book magazine written by, I forget, one of the big celebrity profilers of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a definitive thing. I remember reading in either Marlon's autobiography or that other book by, there's a really good, very thoroughly written book by another author whose name is...
Peter Manso, maybe? It was born by Peter Manso.
Yes. But,
yeah, Peter and Stephen Camford did another one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, in all your research, did you happen to, at the Academy Library, did you ever come upon that particular, I think it's, again, Look magazine, did you ever happen to see?
Oh, no, I saw there was an interesting one in, what was it? It was in, I mean, there's actually cuttings in the film of a magazine, but I think it was the LA... What was it? I'm not Hollywood Reporter, but anyway, it wasn't Look, but there was, you know, an interesting. There was a whole spread what's it around? It was a base. I forget the magazine, unfortunately, but we took scans and I put those in. But mm-hmm. it was talking about the mutiny of Marlon Brando and how it's like the production was like a ghost ship. Mm-hmm. It was the whole article damning Brando, basically.
Mm-hmm. One last thing about the house. The person that bought it obviously made the decision to raise it.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson decided?
Yeah, he was the neighbor.
So he bought it. Yes, I know. Yeah, but I didn't know that it was his decision to tear it down.
Yeah. They were close friends, but he...
I wonder why he would want to tear it down.
I just don't think he needed a second property for a start. You know, he didn't want it to become a mausoleum or a shrine to Brando. Oh. And there'd been a lot of tragedy in there. You know, I think he just probably felt that it was...
Oh, okay.
You know, just wanted to, like, landscape it and bring it into the extent of his property. Having two houses would be a bit strange anyway.
So did Nicholson build another...
No, not as far as I'm aware. I think he just, like, converted it into, like, you know, just garden area and... landscape
right, okay.
Just could guarantee you wouldn't have any neighbors, more privacy.
I was over there like once, remember the whole thing. It's not a Nicholson's place is not huge either. I mean, it's nice, but yeah.
I wonder where he might have. I mean, it'd be interesting to look on Google Earth and see how it's been extended and you know, and what it looks like now.
Right.
But I drove up there before the filming and you know, just to get a feel of the place or just a sense of what his view was.
And someone told me that they both had a kind of a secret entrance that was down in one of the canyons, but they didn't come in from Mulholland. Did you ever read about that or hear about that?
Oh,
a back entrance?
I did actually. There was something along those lines. There might have been that. Yeah, there would have been. And there was another, actually, there was another lady who was, there were three people who were living there, three properties, Marlon's, Jack's, and this other woman, I think she's called Helen Kalianotes or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, she was, okay.
Do you know her?
Yeah.
Have you heard of her?
She used to have a place called Helena's back in the 80s.
Oh, maybe that's it, yeah. Yes, yeah. I didn't know about her, but apparently I think the three of them lived together.
Right.
Or on that hillock, right. Whatever it was. Mm. And I don't know whether she's still there now. But anyway, but between, I think there might have been some access route.
Right.
Wouldn't have surprised me.
Okay, man. Well, very nice to meet you again.
Yeah, pleasure.